I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. All of us are touched by the books we read. Most of us can think back to one book that, for some reason, the story or the characters or the circumstances of that first reading makes it stand apart from all the others. All this week, we're doing a series with writers who select one book and tell us why it made a difference. We're calling it The Book That Changed My Life. Today, my guest is the poet Paul Muldoon, and he's brought along a copy of the book Treasure Island, the 120-year-old pirate classic by Robert Louis Stevenson.
I want you to keep your eye open for a seafaring man with one leg.
A seafaring man with one leg?
Aye.
Upon my word, sir, what shall I tell them? What do they want?
Never you mind what they want. You go on down below and get me a noggin of rum. A double noggin, Jim, because I'm becalmed. Becalmed on a sea of troubles, and I got to fill my sails again.
Yes, sir.
We'd like you to join us. We're interested, first of all, in knowing if the book Treasure Island has any kind of a hold on you, and what that might be. Do you remember the first time you read it, or perhaps it was read to you? Does it still linger in your imagination? We'd also encourage you to call and tell us if there is a book, any book, that changed your life. It won't be enough for you to tell us that, yes, there is such a book. You'll have to be ready to explain why it changed your life. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me this hour is the poet Paul Muldoon. He has numerous collections of his own poetry in print, including Moist Sand and Gravel, which won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize. And Paul's joining us from Princeton, New Jersey. Nice to have you back.
Thank you so much. A great pleasure.
So why Treasure Island?
Well, you know, I was thinking there, listening to that little extract from the movie version of the novel, that character who is looming in the background, a character involving some threatening aspect, I think connected with me quite bluntly, quite directly in my own native land. I was born in 1951, brought up in the 1950s in Ireland. And in that era, as in virtually every era in that country, there was a sense there were groups of men, put bluntly, moving around the countryside up to no good, at least what would have been perceived by many as being up to no good. Now, I don't think I was conscious of that at the time, of course, and indeed there are various other aspects of the story that we might touch upon later. I wasn't conscious of at the time, but I think found some kind of resonance in my condition, as it were. But the immediate impact, I suppose, was that of the ripping yarn, the very aspect of the story that Stevenson had hoped would not, had not, and never would go out of fashion. Adventure of it all.
The interesting thing about going back and rereading the story is how much of the energy and the excitement and the drama in the story all takes place before young Jim and everyone takes to sea.
It's really quite brilliantly set up. There are various little motifs that run through it. For example, when we first meet Billy Bones, the old sea captain, who, as of course turns out to have been one of Flint's crew, as so many of those involved in the voyage on the Hispaniola to Treasure Island turn out to be. You know, there are various little aspects of, for example, when Black Dog arrives at the Admiral Benbow, the isolated inn on the Devon coast, where the family, Jim Hawkins and his mother and his father, are living. When Black Dog comes in and accosts Billy Bones, Billy Bones runs after him with his cutlass swinging and makes a notch on the sign of the Admiral Benbow,
which can be seen to this day. Isn't that true?
Well, that's a great, great, great narrative device, may I say. in that we know at that point that, you know, various... Well, first of all, the narrator clearly is going to survive his own narration, though there is a moment, there are several moments, where that's not altogether clear. For example, there's a critical moment in the book, which we'll come to later on, where the narration is given up by Jim Hawkins, the cabin boy, and taken over by another of the local characters, Dr. Livesey. But as you say, the characters who are immediately to hand there are so brilliantly drawn, and drawn with just a few, I want to say broad strokes, but they seem extraordinarily detailed for all that. The characters of the squire, Trelawney, of the doctor, Livesey, or Livesey, whom I've just mentioned, of the other characters associated with the big house in the district, the characters who come into the pub, are so brilliantly drawn, and there's so many wonderful characters who continue to swim up out of the pages of the novel right the way through. Each of the pirates, quite almost all of them, 90% of them certainly, brilliantly portrayed.
I'm going to ask you, Paul, to read us a small segment of the book. And this would be while we're still in the Hawkins family inn, the Admiral Benbow. We've got Billy Bones, the old sea captain, upstairs, and old Blind Pugh coming to the door. Is that, have you got that place marked under the chapter, The Black Spot?
Yes, I have. There's Blind Pugh has been spotted by Jim Hawkins tapping along the road. He comes up to the boy. I held out my hand, and the horrible, soft-spoken, eyeless creature gripped it in a moment like a vice. I was so much startled that I struggled to withdraw. But the blind man pulled me close up to him with a single action of his arm. "Now, boy," he said, "take me into the captain." "Sir," said I, "upon my word, I dare not." "Oh," he sneered, "that's it. Take me in straight or I'll break your arm." And he gave it, as he spoke, a wrench that made me cry out. "Sir," said I, "it is for yourself, I mean. The captain is not what he used to be. He sits with a drawn cutlass. Another gentleman..." "Come now, march," interrupted he, and I never heard a voice so cruel and cold and ugly as that blind man's. It cowed me more than the pain, and I began to obey him at once, walking straight in at the door and towards the parlour, where our sick old buccaneer was sitting, dazed with rum. The blind man clung close to me, holding me in one iron fist, and leaning almost more of his weight on me than I could carry. "Lead me straight up to him, and when I'm in view, cry out, 'Here's a friend for you, Bill.' If you don't, I'll do this." And with that he gave me a twitch that I thought would have me faint. Between this and that, I was so utterly terrified of the blind beggar that I forgot my terror of the captain, and as I opened the parlour door, cried out the words he had ordered in a trembling voice. The poor captain raised his eyes, and at one look the rum went out of him and left him staring sober. The expression of his face was not so much of terror as of mortal sickness. He made a movement to rise, but I do not believe he had enough force left in his body. "Now, Bill, sit where you are," said the beggar. "If I can't see, I can hear a finger stirring. Business is business. Hold out your left hand. Boy, take his left hand by the wrist and bring it to my right." We both obeyed him to the letter, and I saw him pass something from the hollow of the hand that held his stick into the palm of the captain's, which closed upon it instantly. "And now that's done," said the blind man. And at the words, he suddenly left hold of me, and with incredible accuracy and nimbleness skipped out of the parlour and into the road, where, as I still stood motionless, I could hear his stick go tap, tap, tapping into the distance. It was some time before either I or the captain seemed to gather our senses, but at length, and about the same moment, I released his wrist, which I was still holding, and he drew in his hand and looked sharply into the palm. 10 o'clock, he cried. 6 hours. We'll do them yet. And he sprang to his feet. Even as he did so, he reeled, put his hand to his throat, stood swaying for a moment, and then, with a peculiar sound, fell from his whole height, face foremost, to the floor.
That from Treasure Island, by Robert Louis Stevenson, read by my guest this hour, the poet Paul Muldoon. It is the first in our series, The Book That Changed My Life. And Connection listeners, we're inviting you in to join us with either your recollections, your memory as of Treasure Island, or maybe another book that changed your life. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back, a chance to talk a little bit more about the book itself, about the characters, and about the man who wrote it, and a chance to take our conversation a little bit further. What did change your life? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This is the first in our series, The Book That Changed My Life. The poet Paul Muldoon is with me, and we're talking about Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. We'd like to hear from you as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And Paul, just to go back, was the book read to you when you were very small? Did you read it yourself?
I read it myself, so far as I recall. You know, I was brought up in a strange-ish household, I think, in that my mother, despite the fact that she was a school teacher, had very few books in the house. And there were some of the obvious candidates, of course, that had made it through. The New Testament, which was the part of the Bible, I suppose, that interested us most. And that sort of was the main book in the house. There was... I remember in 1961, when I was 10, I got a present of a book called The Golden Book of California, which was a book that was very important to me. This extraordinary lustrous quality of the photographs, the reproductions of paintings and photographs in it. It was a book that was somehow had the sun shining on and out of it, then we had the Junior World Encyclopedia, which was a series of books that had been sold to us by a travelling salesman. But apart from that, there was very, very, very little in the way of books in the house. My father was one of those men of a certain generation in Ireland, and I think probably in this country too, who'd not had a higher education and who could barely read or write. So it was a strange household in that respect. Of course, I went to school and I began reading books, and I know that Treasure Island, I suppose when I was 10, 11, 12, must have been one of the first books that I read, and I'm sure that, of course, was part of its impact.
I wonder if you felt that Jim Hawkins was a character that you could identify with. At the same
well,
time.
He was, absolutely. He absolutely was. And again, I wouldn't have been conscious of this at the time, and even now it seems a little bit like Psychology 101. But, you know, Psychology 101 probably has its place in the world. I'm certain it does. And just in terms of the dynamics, as they say, in all the best circles of my own family, I had a very strong mother, just as Mrs. Hawkins turns out to be, a terrifically strong person who one can see as having run the Admiral Benbow, really in lieu of the father. My father was a distant, not cold in any sense, but just a distant person. He was going about his own business, as it were, and had a certain kind of fecklessness, which was wonderful in its way, but which I think was probably reminiscent for me of the father in that story. The father who, for example, hasn't the nerve in the Admiral Benbow to ask old Billy Bones for his keep, the money, in other words, that he's owed by Billy Bones. He hasn't the nerve to ask for. And my father, in fact, at one point when I was born, was keeping, or shortly after, was keeping a shop, a shop in which they sold some of the same items, certainly plug tobacco, if not pigtail tobacco, as one sees there in the accoutrements of Treasure Island. And basically, I think many of the local people, when he gave up the shop, owed him money, which he never really collected. So it's the mother, of course, who finding the great treasure chest when Billy Bones dies, as he does there, shortly after the father dies, indeed, who takes it upon herself to in lieu of some of the money still owed to her, because there's such a collection of coins from all round the world that she has trouble counting out a few guineas from it, she takes the canvas, little canvas bag or package in which what turns out to be the map of Treasure Island, of course,
it's a great part
included.
Of the scene, because at that very moment, of course, the pirates are coming clattering down the road to try and get their hands on the sea chest. And here's young Jim saying to his mother, "We've got to get out of here." And the mother's saying, "I'm not going to take any more money than I'm owed." Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you. So let's start in Boston. Leslie's on the line. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
A favorite story of yours?
Well, I'm a teacher at a public school in Boston, and I read this book, an abridged version of it, aloud to my students at the beginning of the year.
What grade, Leslie?
Fifth grade.
Yeah.
Well, fourth and fifth together, but they're just obsessed with the book, and they haven't stopped talking about it all year.
Have you figured out why, what it is about the book that appeals, Leslie?
Well, I like the book a lot. I think the... You know, when I read it aloud to them, I sort of did the voices, you know, and just the adventure, you know, the pirates and missing fingers, you know, and things like this. But they became obsessed with the black spot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you're reading that earlier, right?
That's so right.
I'm still getting pieces of paper with the black spot on it.
Just the last thing one wants to see, I'm sure, as one comes into school in the morning, is the black spot.
Well, I found one tucked in my backpack when I got home. You know?
Well, it's such a powerful, powerful image, isn't it? And the black spot, of course, delivered by Pew, the signal, in other words, from the other pirates who've met in conclave, that basically a life is going to end. Is picked up, of course, later in the book when, on Treasure Island itself, the pirates get together and decide to attempt to oust their erstwhile leader, their true leader, Long John Silver, and they give him a black spot. And the way, of course, they go about it is, doubly terrifying in a strange way. It certainly was to me, again, as a child, in a house where the Bible or some version of it was squarely at the heart of things, was that they cut the little circle of paper out of a page of the Bible, and then they give it to Long John Silver, and he himself is appalled by the fact that they've raided a page of the Bible for the black spot. But I think the association with a religious text, or indeed with religious life, is one that gave me, anyhow, as a child brought up as a Catholic, as it turns out, in Northern Ireland, with somehow I connected that round piece of black paper with the host, the communion host. And I think it, which of course was the, what would one say, the negative version of it, the white version of it. And it seemed particularly potent somehow, particularly if it was delivered in the palm of the hand. And I know this sounds a little outrageous, perhaps a little far-fetched, but it was something having to do with that that I think made it even more potent for me.
I laughed when I heard that you'd chosen Treasure Island, because in fact it's one of my favorite books. But I would always be somewhat reluctant to put it on my list, Paul, because my father read it to me, and I'm completely unable to separate the recollection of that intimacy and the sort of nightly terror of having it end or begin at a frightening moment with the pirates, knowing that something was going to change the following night. Do you know what I mean? That it's almost as if the literature then gets so wound into a childhood or an experience that you have a hard time assessing it on its own.
Yes, except perhaps in the sense that literature is meant to connect with us. I mean, surely one of the functions of literature, art with a capital A, is to touch us, and to touch us so forcibly, indeed, as to make us, well, for example, make us have, when we think of pirates, to think only of Long John Silver and that particular crew. When we think of treasure on an island, this is this particular version has superseded all others. And we must remember that when Stevenson wrote this book, there was already a genre of adventure story. Some of them, of course, having to do with pirates and islands, but he made that genre so much his own that it's impossible for us to imagine a pirate speaking, indeed, without thinking of Long John Silver, in many instances perhaps with Robert Newton in that great film version of it speaking the words. But, you know, while Johnny Depp may lean a little towards Keith Richards for his and why wouldn't he, for his take on Captain Jack Sparrow, he's also leaning much more heavily towards Robert Newton. And
I'm interested in this, though. I mean, the Dread Pirate Roberts in The Princess Bride has the same sort of mince in his step. And in a way, Paul, the pirates have become much more romantic characters in our lives than I would imagine they were at the time when Robert Louis Stevenson wrote about them in the late 1800s. These were really bad people.
You know, they are really bad people. And one of the great glories of this book is that it never loses sight of that. Or if it does, if one's taken in, as Jim is taken in from time to time, by the charming, charming, charming aspect of Long John Silver, who can talk out of both sides of his mouth at once, as we say in Ireland, which, by the way, I'm sure is another trait that I recognised, the terrific gift of the gab that this character has, where he can, as my father would have said, he can argue a black crow white, and he can persuade this group of mutineers that they've got to do this or that. You know, he is also the man whom Jim watches hurl his crutch at a seaman on the island, just when they first get on the island, who hasn't quite signed up with the pirates, and who never will, hurls a crutch at him, breaks his back in the process, then falls forward again in a motion not unreminiscent of Billy Bones falling forward there, and buries his knife in the pirate's back, not once but twice. And there are so many descriptions of the the criminality of these characters, of as someone has pointed out recently, I've just been reading actually a rather wonderful new biography by Claire Harmon of Robert Louis Stevenson, and she points out rather wittily that even the old pirate, Captain Flint, named in memory of the of their former leader, Captain Flint, who, of course, we associate mostly with the phrase pieces of eight, the currency, as it were, that they were all after, pieces of eight. Also, peppers his talk with language that, let's say we're certainly not going to hear on NPR this morning.
let me go back to our callers. To Boston, Peter's joining us. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Great topic. I'm probably a couple years older than your professor. I think I was probably around the fifth or sixth grade in the greater Boston area. I think it was like in public schools. That was one of the assigned readings. And I think that was the first book that really inculcated in me a real desire to read. And I had taken great solace. And one of the things I was fortunate, my dad was a police sergeant at the time out in the old precursor to the state police, MDC, and they used to go out to George's Island. And I was able to stay, and it was Fort Warren. And there was a quote I remember from Captain Long John Silver about Flint. And the quote was something like, "I didn't fear him when he was alive, and I don't fear him when he was dead." And I used to think of that. And I remember going out at nighttime at midnight in Fort Warren and say, "That's right. There's nothing to fear about this." And it kind of gave me a background that, like, hey, all you got to do is just, you know, just listen to things and observe things. It was a great line, and I built on it. And I thought it was an adventurous type of book for a young fellow, and it certainly did a lot for me. And in fact, since I couldn't be a buccaneer, I ended up joining the Marine Corps. But I certainly identified more with, I guess, with the buccaneers and the pirates at the time than I did with Jim Hawkins. But I would say that was mine. Then the second best book for me was Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. That was the other. But it's certainly the foundation, would I be saying.
Isn't it funny, Peter, how the line sticks in your head?
Yeah. Well,
go ahead, Paul.
That line comes, of course, as Peter will remember, at the moment where, towards the end of the book, where they hear this character, the pirates hear this character whom they can't account for. Now, we know that it's the extraordinary Ben Gunn who's making this these observations about the death of a character, another character in Flint's crew, whom only a pirate, only one of them would know, and yet they know that there are five of them, I think, left at that point, and they can't, for the life of them, work out who this could possibly be. One of the things that Stevenson does really well is to, I suppose one would call it dramatic irony, is that there are a number of situations through the book where we know that, for example, Ben Gunn can only be the character who's speaking here, whereas the characters in the scene simply don't know who it is. And it's yet another aspect of the book that gives it depth, because the narrative, for the most part, is really quite extraordinarily well handled. And we remember, of course, that it first came into the world as a serialized story.
The same way Dickens did in the newspapers?
Absolutely, absolutely. And wouldn't it be great if we had a bit more of that these days? I mean, it might result in a few more, what would one say, Perils of Pauline, cliffhanger types of chapter endings, but would that be so wrong?
Let me stop you there. 1-800-423-8255. This hour and the start of our series, The Book That Changed My Life, A Consideration of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. My guest is the poet Paul Muldoon. We'd like to hear from you on Treasure Island or perhaps on another book that changed your life. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll be right back. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. The poet Paul Muldoon is starting us off on our series, The Book That Changed My Life, his selection, Treasure Island. What's yours? 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Richard, who's joining us from South Carolina. Hi, Richard. What's your book?
Hello. Huck Finn.
Why?
Huck Finn and Treasure Island both are great works for young adults, I suppose, and only later when you see it on a college syllabus do you realize it's actually literature. Somebody tricked you with a good story into reading literature.
Well, it's kind of the art of Treasure Island, too, isn't it, Richard? That
yes, it is.
You're just thinking you're reading a good story.
It is. You're not looking for any for great writing or a deeper meaning. It's just a good story.
Well, there's no reason, I guess, why the two shouldn't and combine. In fact, most of the time, why they shouldn't combine. But I think I myself make very little distinction between high and low literature. I mean, I don't really know if one needs to get involved in that. If one's reading a book, my son at the moment is reading the Tales of Captain Underpants, for example. That's a ripping good yarn. And, the thing about Huckleberry Finn, actually, that connects with Treasure Island is, funnily enough, the fact that halfway through each of those books, their authors, who met, by the way, later on, in 1888, I think it was, they met in New York, but in each instance, despite the fact that we think of them now as been such ripping yarns and such continuous narratives, we remember that in both cases they ran into trouble. If you recall, Mark Twain stopped writing The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn when he realized that as Huck and Jim made their way south down the river, Jim was moving. There was a plot problem because Jim was moving further south. And his situation as a black man further south was going to be more problematic. Stevenson gave up writing Treasure Island round about the end of chapter 15, chapter 16, because he didn't know what to do next.
What's that stage in the story?
Well, you know what? That is the point that I mentioned earlier on, where he changes the narrative character, narration to the doctor. And actually, I think it's a little bit of a flaw in the book. If he'd had more time, perhaps, to think about it, he would have introduced multiple narrators, or at least brought Livesey or Livesey, however one pronounces it. I think there are various schools of thought back, perhaps, or introduced him earlier, just to give it the sense that, as is the case with so much art, that he meant it all along, rather than simply wasn't up against a wall. But funnily enough, it's at that very moment, as someone else has pointed out shortly afterward, at that moment, that Jim Hawkins is adrift. He's adrift in the coracle with Ben Gunn's coracle, the little
boat, goats, yeah.
The little goatskin boat. And, of course, it's the way Twain gets out of his problem is to have the ferry run down the raft and get them on shore. So I suppose this is what would one call it, a boat or ferry or coracle ex machina.
Richard, let me come back to you just on the distinction that you make, because I kind of get the same point. When you're having just so much fun reading a book, you think that there can't be anything good in it. It must be just all pleasure. I mean, I understand what Paul's saying as well, but when we begin reading books, there are the books we read for pleasure and the books we have to read, and these are two that fit in the middle, I guess.
They do. They bridge that gap, and I suppose make you realize that great writing can be entertaining also.
Do you ever go back and read either one of them?
Yes. In fact, I probably read them both at a young age for pleasure, and then read them in a high school literature class, and then again in college. Probably read both books four or five times.
Paul, how many times have you read Treasure Island?
Well, I read it, I'd say, every couple of years, just for fun, for the pure delight of it. And, you know, as I listen there, I'm horrified and terrified, particularly as a teacher myself, to be reminded again of the terrific responsibility that teachers have. We heard earlier from one of, I think the first caller we heard from, do you remember, announced that one of the reasons why the children were having such a good time was that she loved the book. And I think, you know, if we, as teachers, if we can bring something of that enthusiasm to the business, rather than what so often turns out to be the case, and I'm sure necessarily is the case, mm-hmm. of the kind of deadening effect of the book report and the the kind of this terrible sense of duty that comes to attend the business of reading, and so that and the sense that one needs someone, some help to get through a book of literature with a capital L. It's a problem.
Let's go to Newport, Rhode Island for a call from Sheila. Sheila's joining us there. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. I had an instant reaction to that question you posed at the beginning of the program, what one book had an impact on you. I mean, I love Treasure Island. I was a big reader as a kid, but for me, the answer has got to be Little Women. I read that book so many times when I was a kid. The first 50 pages of my hardcover copy fell off. I really, I'm not kidding. That book was a constant companion for me during, I would say, a couple of key years in my maybe preteen years. I identified so much with the Joe March character in that book. And I think, so beyond the fact that it was a work of fiction and it was a great story, I mean, it had drama and humor and mystery and, you know, problem and resolution, and it had an impact on me because of the role model in the book. And I grew up in a family of seven kids. I have five sisters of us and two brothers. And my parents were not the kind of people ever to tell us, girls, you can't do this, you can't do that because you're a girl. But still, there was just something that was so empowering about Jo. It was her independence and the fact that she was a little different from the other girls in the family and her angst as she kind of pursued the right course of her life. I mean,
so Sheila, did the book give you something that you couldn't get anywhere else? I mean, in part, that's what Paul was saying about his first encounter with Treasure Island.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I could say that I couldn't have gotten that somewhere else, but the book certainly encapsulated it all, and it wrapped it up in a package of entertaining reading that made me want to read it. I just couldn't stop. That's why all the pages fell off the book. But that's all I wanted to say. I mean, I just had a visceral and instantaneous response. There was no other answer for me but Little Women.
You know, I think one of the aspects of this book, that it might easily indeed be the title of this book, it's so powerful, this book might be called Little Boys, because it was written, indeed, it first appeared as The Sea Cook or Treasure Island, A Story for Boys. And the little boy for whom Stevenson wrote it, Little Sam, it seems insisted that there be no women in it. And I wonder in that sense if this isn't more of a book that has much more male appeal, perhaps, insofar as we're still allowed to suggest such things. You know, I think that some young women may feel slightly shut out of a story like this that is so determinedly and in many cases so grimly male.
Let's go to Boston. Roger's joining us there. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Wonderful program. I just wanted to say that the two books that had the greatest impact on me as a child were Treasure Island, read to me by my dad, and Wind in the Willows, read to me by my mom. And those two books reflected the very different personalities and backgrounds that of my mom and my dad. And the other thing that I wanted to point out was that N.C. Wyeth, Andrew Wyeth's father, illustrated the original Scribner's classics, including Treasure Island. And that stands apart as a great body of the illustrator's art. But I think his illustrations were quite idealized and And
take me back, if you can, to the personalities encapsulated in the books that were read to you. I mean, I get the Treasure Island part, but Wind in the Willows is water rats and a toad.
I'm trying to remember the all the characters.
But it was
Ratty and Toad, and who was the other one? Oh, Jesus.
It's just that it is the book that reflects the personality of your mother
written by an English author, I believe.
Yes.
And my mom lived and went to school in Britain, and it was her favorite childhood book. And Treasure Island, my dad was a big fan of Robert Louis Stevenson, and he had memorized some of his poems, and he just loved Stevenson's works. And
jump in here, Paul. You were going to talk
about... Yeah, it was Kenneth Graham who wrote The Wind and the Willows.
Okay.
And again, it's a ripping yarn. Toad going out for a drive in his motor car. The character of Toad, I once heard a wonderful talk by a fellow teacher at Princeton suggesting that Toad is actually a character based on Oscar Wilde, and that the first representations of Wind and the Willows, the way Toad stands around is actually based on various representations of Oscar Wilde. That's right. Now, I think part of the point here is that the way in which we first see these characters visualized is, of course, for the most part, in our mind's eye. As they say, it's one of the reasons why radio is so much more interesting than television, is that the pictures are better. But we have, in the case of Wyeth, we have those representations of the pirates, for those who are familiar with the American editions, and I think they came across to the UK and Ireland also, though I don't remember seeing Wyeth as a child. Those really establish how one views the character in ways that are, I think, at once limiting as well as been revelatory.
Although I recall seeing some of them and thinking that the pirates are just about as dastardly and evil in the illustrations as they were in my mind. I'm going to go to Providence, Rhode Island for a call from Robert. Hi, Robert.
Delighted to be here. This is one of the most important books in my life. My first recollection of my father in any kind of capacity other than just being a father was reading to me at the age of 3 or 4. Every night I'd go to bed and he'd read me a chapter from the Treasure Island, and it was just the most magnificent thing because he brought it so much to life. And I think it taught me how to be a storyteller and changed my life. One part of my life I went to sea and was a naval officer. Another part of my life I owned an inn and almost called it the Admiral Benbow Inn. And now I'm writing a novel about an ancestor of mine of that sort of that period who fought the pirates. And turns out that they were pretty despicable characters. And so it's...
I think you win the prize for connections to Treasure Island here, Robert.
And I read the book a couple of years ago again, but I don't think we could ever separate the book from the movie with Robert Louis Stevenson, with Robert Newton when he played Long John Silver. And so the images of the book and the images of the movie are so intertwined in my mind that I can't tell the two apart anymore.
It is difficult, certainly, but you know, one of the great aspects of this book is that Stevenson is quite a wonderful reporter, as it were, of direct speech. A lot of this book takes place in dialogue, and his ear for quite a range of rhythms. I mean, many of these people, of course, are speaking a dialect of Western, the Devon, Cornwall, the Western tip of the of Great Britain. There are various. There are characters I think are almost certainly Irish. Ben Gunn, for example, I think is an Irish character. A little bit far fetched, perhaps, but he, for example, is quite a common name in Scotland and Ireland. Magilla Gunna as it is in Irish.
Well, you fantasized about picking up the story of Ben Gunn at some point, have you not, Paul?
You know, I have. Did I mention that before? If I had any ability at all, if I thought I were able to do it, I would love to try to write a little sequel to Treasure Island. I've often thought about it, but frankly, I would be cowed by that possibility, because he does it so brilliantly that I don't think I could do it. I'm sure someone who had a better sense of writing prose, or if I did it, it would take me 20 years and would probably be rubbish. But I do love the after story, as it were, where Ben Gunn, who of course is a version of Robinson Crusoe skipping around with his goatskins, and indeed there's a sort of subtext, a sort of English lit subtext, if I may step into the old professorial road for a minute. Captain Smollett, we recall, is the captain of the Hispaniola, and one of Stevenson's main his predecessors in Scottish literature was, of course, Tobias Smollett, who also specialised in ripping yarns, including sea stories, and in that sense was Stevenson's captain. But anyway, Gunn goes back to England. He spends the £1,000 or whatever it is, 1,000 guineas that he gets, in 2 or 3 weeks, eats more cheese than could possibly be good for him, but ends up going to church, that Bible again, and singing his head off. But the afterlives, as it were, of the pirates and the main characters, those of them who survive the horrors, to go back to that aspect of again of this journey, somehow open the possibility of other lives for all of us.
It's imagination, I guess, more than anything else, the ability to exercise it and to pass it along to someone else. And Stevenson does that, and your experience with that has given us another taste of that. Paul, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Paul Muldoon is the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. His forthcoming book of essays is called The End of the Poem. And just a note for you, on our website at theconnection.org, you can be a part of this series, The Book That Changed My Life, by using that as a route into our forums. Tomorrow we'll be talking with the novelist Sheila Kohler about J.M. Coetzee's book Disgrace. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.